And I was like, that one? And they're like, yes, don't fuck around, do that.
Hello there. Welcome back to the Wild Business Growth Podcast. This is your place to hear from a new entrepreneur every single Wednesday morning who's turning wild ideas into wild growth. I'm your host, Max Brandstetter, founder and podcast producer at Max Podcasting, and you can email me at max@maxpodcasting.com to save time with your high-quality podcast. This is episode 255, and today's Shiggity Schwam guest is Robert Bruner. Robert is a legendary industrial designer who is the chief designer of Beats by Dre. He is the founder of the design firm Ammunition. He served as the head of industrial design at Apple. He's been a partner at Pentagram. Many, many, many more stops that we talk about all in each of those in this episode, as well as the inside scoop of what makes Apple and Beats by Dre so game-changing in the world of design. We also talk what it's like to work with Dr. Dre, what do you call Dr. Dre in the office, and some more of the coolest people Robert has met through his design journey. It is R&B. Enjoy the show. Alrighty, we are here with Robert Bruner, one of the brightest minds in the world of design, which kind of rhymes, and sorry, I should just leave now. But Robert, so excited to speak with you. Thanks so much for making time today. How are you doing today?
I am fantastic. Thank you very much. Really, really happy to be here.
Of course, of course. Back at you. And we could talk for probably days straight on everything that you've touched in your career and all the designs you've played a part in. But I wanted to start off going back in time and making you think about, was there any indication growing up that you wanted to work with and work for these giant, massive brands like Apple, Beats by Dre, Pentagram? Like those are huge goals for a lot of designers. What was your outlook on that?
When I'm growing up, I had no idea that such a career existed. You know, when I get to look back through the, you know, through the lens of time, I can see the seeds. You know, my and a lot comes from your family and your parents. My father was an incredibly accomplished, talented, creative engineer. He actually invented a lot of the mechanical technology and disk drives, the first disk drives at IBM. And he was just an inventor, and he was always building stuff in the garage. He built a couple of boats in our driveway, that's just who he was. And then my mother was originally a fashion model, but as she became a homemaker, she was a craftsperson and an artist, and our home, everything was a project. You know, that's just how things operated, and there was always something being built or created. So that, you know, when I look back at that, I can see, yeah, that makes sense. You know, and I spent a lot of time in the garage building bicycles and doing whatever, you know, just kind of watching my dad and so forth. So it makes sense, right, that I ended up in this space. But when I went to school, I had no idea that this design career existed. I just stumbled onto it.
So what was the scene at your house like? Was there, how many disk drives and prototypes of things were there, like, everywhere you stepped?
Oh, it was hilarious. I mean, I'll date myself, but we used to have these, like, my dad, the first disk drives were created with these 14-inch Winchester disk drives. So I had these platters all around the house. We used to play frisbee with them. And I remember one time he was coming up with a new mechanism, and I had one of these telescoping bicycle pumps, you know, the kind you put on your frame of your bike, and he destroyed it making a mock-up, you know, to figure out how this mechanism worked. I was really pissed at him because he never replaced it. He just grabbed it and used it as a prop. So yeah, that was always going on. And I joke about my mom because, you know, she, every year the Christmas tree was different. It was like a piece of performance art. There was always a concept, like, can't we just have ornaments, you know, this year? No, this year it's pink ornaments and pink bows. That's it. You know, that's all we're doing. You know, it's just, that was what my mom was like. So, you know, that's, you just absorb that stuff, right? And you just start thinking in that way and tackling problems in that way. And it filters into who you are.
That sounds like something out of a movie or documentary or something like that. It'd be a very entertaining and inspiring household to be in. Those examples are kind of learning by example and stuff rubbing off on you that way. were there specific lessons that your mom or dad told you that were ended up being pretty foundational in your decision to choose design?
No, it was more absorption, but my decision to choose design was kind of interesting because I, you know, when I graduated from high school, you go and see, you know, the counselor who tells you, looks at your records, says, you should do this, right? And he looked and said, you're good in math and science. Your dad's an engineer. You're an engineer. So, okay, great. I'll study engineering. You know, but he didn't look at my history and art and shop and, you know, which I was like straight A student, you know, in all those areas. I was like a B and C student and everything else. But and when it came to anything creative, I was, you know, straight A. But it was a bit of an indictment because, you know, in the educational system and even today, that isn't as valued as highly as it should be. I enrolled at San Jose State University. I was a civil engineering because I thought, you know, that would be cool to build bridges, right? Or work on the Alaska pipeline or do something like that, right? And then somebody told me, all the money's in electrical design. Oh, okay. Well, I switched to electrical engineering. I was about a year into it and just not feeling it. I mean, I was doing all right, but it just didn't, it was sort of the engineering core classes were like, okay, here's a problem. Here's a book. Go find the solution in the book and, you know, and solve the problem. That didn't feel very good to me. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to rebel. I went over to the art department. I had heard of this thing called graphic design, you know, which was some form of commercial art. And I like to draw and paint and things. It's following my mom that way. And I walked in the building and I went in the door and there was this display case full of industrial design stuff. You know, it was renderings and models and, you know, sketches. And I just like stood there and said, okay, this is it. This makes sense. And I went to the administrative building and changed my major, which, you know, pissed my father off. He saw, I remember this quote. My dad's no longer with us, but he said, you know, Robert, industrial designers are the people who specify the paint and it usually peels off, was what he's, you know, it's like he had zero respect for industrial design. Being a mechanical engineer, he just saw them as people that made his life more difficult. Tough, you know, I'm doing this anyway. And, you know, he came to understand and actually became a supporter. But in the beginning, it was kind of like, you know, why are you doing this? You're going to throw your career down the tubes, you know, going, you know, spending all your time in the art building. Right? That, you know, so that was how I actually found out about design. It was literally, if I'd gone in another door, you know, I could, who knows, you know, I could be a starving sculptor or something, you know.
Much to your father's chagrin, let's get to industrial design and design overall. So in your own words, how do you distinguish industrial design versus other types of design?
Well, I mean, let's start with design. You know, for me, design is, you know, at its core is the purposeful creation of something, right? It's really, you know, people are designing things all the time. They're creating, but you know, when you're very purposeful about what you're doing with a goal and some directionality to it, I think that's really what design is about. Industrial design can be pretty broad. It tends to be around things that are three-dimensional. It tends to be around, at its core, artifacts that are produced at scale. But, you know, it can lead towards architecture. It can lead towards human interface. It can lean towards graphic design. It can lean towards a lot of areas. But at the core, it tends to be the creation of things that are going to be built and built in quantities of two to a bazillion, right? And so it's really about that and all that goes into it and all that goes into making something usable, useful, and desirable for people. That's kind of it for me. You know, everything can have a different direction and mine's kind of pragmatic, but it's really about these creation of things that we fill our lives with.
Do you have a few key principles that, you know, still to this day with Ammunition Group, you try to instill to new hires about approaching design?
You know, one of the things that really I became, you know, when I first, you know, saw that display case and switched to design, I was really interested in the, like I said, the artifacts and drawing and, you know, I remember going from, you know, hours and hours of daily homework around physics and calculus to sketching and, you know, making models. And, you know, it's like, God, I'm in heaven. What is this? You know, this is actually college. I can't believe it. And so I was enamored by that. But then I began to, as I studied it and studied what it was about, I began to be fascinated by this relationship that people have with things as a species, we, you know, surround ourselves with things that we like and many times define who we are and we have a connection to, you know, and, you know, if you look at the car you drive or the shoes you wear or the, you know, briefcase you have, all these things, you know, you've selected, and many times you have this sort of connection to it, you know, that extends well beyond its functionality. And that was fascinating to me, you know, that people are drawn to things and put meaning in them. So that was kind of a high level thing. So I also, you know, it's interesting because I mentioned I went to San Jose State University, which was a great school because my dad loved it because it wasn't expensive being a California resident, but it also, they had this sort of very practical approach to design, which was really around two main areas, problem solving and developing skills. It didn't really have a philosophical backbone, right? It really wasn't sort of, you know, this is what good design means, you know. Somehow I became really interested in European designers and modernism and postmodernism as an approach, right? And I was different than most of my classmates. You know, they were more driven by Star Wars and Atari and things like that at the time that were, you know, sort of culturally relevant. You know, I remember when my senior critique, there was a German designer, I don't remember who he was, who was came in as a guest, and he looked at my work and he says, "I can't believe an American has designed such a thing," you know, was his comment. And so, that sort of filters down into these sort of simplicity, a cleanliness about design, clarity, functionality, the sort of very sort of core principles around building things that have longevity. But there was a little bit of it that my influence, again, from where I was and where I was sitting in California, that also was around expressionism. You know, I just had this feeling that things should have a personality. And I became fascinated with, there was an Italian architect and designer named Mario Bellini, who's still around, still practicing. And he had done this work for Olivetti, which was really, in my opinion, the beginnings of technology design, you know, but at that time it was around calculators and typewriters and things like that. But I always looked at his work and the things always looked like they were moving, like they were getting ready to take off or they had just landed or just, you know, these static things on your desk, but they had life and energy about them. And I became really obsessed with his work and it really sort of drove my early thinking. So I'm sort of this modernist backbone, but with a desire to give things character and personality. And that became a sort of a defining approach to my work.
Yeah, it's really interesting hearing you go through the background and your motives and interests there, because of course there's the whole passion around design and the acumen there, but there's also this interest in like the more traditional arts and being inspired by that. And then I guess what you'd sum up as meaning, like stuff having meaning. And so it's really cool to hear that. Like it's not just in simple form of like, we want to make stuff that looks cool. It's like, we want to keep the focus on people having a connection with the products that they use and people having, you know, connections with each other, you know, through these products as vehicles. That's awesome. And like a really, I feel, unique perspective to have there. When you look at the different stops in your career, like it's amazing for somebody to not just start to get into this space from, you know, that experience walking through a door, but also to get a quote unquote big break and start working with like major, major companies. How did the Apple opportunity present itself for you in the first place?
Yeah, it's a great story. I out of school, I'd worked in a local firm in Palo Alto. It was actually a fairly large firm at the time. And I met a couple guys and we sort of connected, Gerard Frobisher and Jeff Smith. And we decided to leave and start our own company, which became a studio called Lunar, which still exists. And so we just had this sort of really great partnership where I tended to be more of the creative lead and Gerard was more of the technical guy and Jeff was more of the process guy. And we kind of, you know, were able to tackle stuff. And so we had been working, doing our thing. And at the time, going back in history, that Steve Jobs really caught the industrial design bug and brought in Hartmut Esslinger, who's a German designer, and his company Frog Design, and they really sort of set up shop in Silicon Valley. At the time, a couple other groups, had formed coming over from Europe. And, you know, I think these guys were great and they really saw the potential of technology. You know, so I was working in that space and then was, but Frog had Apple really locked up in this airtight contract. They couldn't work with other design firms. Got this call from a guy named Bill Dresselhaus, who actually was the original designer of the Lisa, like for Mac, Apple, going way back, like pre-Mac. And he was still there, and he had this, was working on this sort of Skunkworks project. And he asked us to work on it, and he said, but, you know, you can't call it industrial design. You're doing engineering, okay? But we were really doing industrial design. And later I kind of realized it was a test. You know, it was sort of, they were moving out of that relationship. They wanted to find other people to work with, and it was a bit of a test. And apparently we passed. I passed, so we started doing more projects, and then the Frog relationship broke up, and they started, you know, we just began working on projects. You know, for me, which was freaking amazing, just, you know, I was just, you know, maybe 4 years out of school, you know, and all of a sudden doing work for Apple, and somehow even got major responsibility on some things. And, you know, and a part of it, I think, you know, going back to that childhood thing, somehow I got this thing from my parents, which, you know, loosely translates, you know, don't ask for permission, ask for forgiveness, right? And it's sort of, you know, just do it and figure it out. And so that was kind of the way I approached it. So doing these projects, really loving it, having a great time. And then one day I get a call from this headhunter. And it was sort of weird because he was hired by the head of product design at Apple, who I was working with. But he had this, and I said, you know, look, we're looking for a new design director. Are you interested? And I thought, oh, wow, that's flattering. Okay, yeah, let's talk about it and see. You know, I was really happy what I was doing. It wasn't like I was looking for anything. And started to dive into it. And at that time, their internal design team wasn't doing a lot of their own work. They were largely managing external designers. And I just said, you know what, I'm not really interested in that. I'm a designer. I make stuff. That's what I do. I don't want to go into a pure management position and watch other people do the fun stuff. And so I said no, which like shocked them. I said, okay. And so they went away. And then about 3 months later, they came back and said, look, we've been searching. We really think you're the person, you know, what would it take? And, you know, so going back to that, watch out what you ask for thing. I said, you know what? Apple, if any company could have a world-class design studio, and if you wanted to build that, I'd be interested in that. And they said, okay, let's do that. And so I decided, you know, really hard decision, because I loved, you know, my Jeff and Gerard. I loved what we were doing at Lunar. We'd built it up from just the three of us into like, you know, 18 people, which was, you know, substantial, you know. But it was kind of like, you know, and I was, you know, like all of 26, 27 years old. And I remember thinking, you know, you're young enough to make a big mistake and recover. So let's just do this. And so I did. And so that's how the Apple opportunity came about, and just dove into figuring out how to build this studio and team that could really sort of drive not just the company, but, you know, the world, turn out the world of design.
Your next book could be called The Man Who Rejected Apple.
I think that's right.
Going to be, you're going to take that to the grave, but there's an asterisk there, because obviously you partner with them and had an amazing career stop there and collaborations. So it's really interesting, the angle with Apple is that your focus was on like building that design studio and really kind of instilling that in the culture, or making that a bigger part of the culture there. What's your favorite memory from those several years you had at Apple in that role?
Well, one of the ones which always, I remember getting there and thinking, what the fuck have I done? Because Apple, at the time, and to some degree still is an engineering-driven culture. I mean, it really is driven a lot by technology and, you know, and the things that they're creating there. And I got, and I, you know, I was shown to my desk, which was a 10x12 windowless cubicle of Herman Miller Action Office furniture in a sea of engineers. And I'm just like sitting there depressed as hell. It's like, I can't work in this space. I what have I done? You know, and now I've got to restart from scratch and figure all this out. And so I remember that, sitting there like the second or third day, just feeling like, oh God, can I get out of this? But, you know, and then along the way, and then there was this project that was just starting, which, you know, became the PowerBook, which became the MacBook. It was a mess, right? This is a history lesson. Apple's first portable computer was the size of a sewing machine. And it was, you know, just kind of an industry laughing point. And some others had come out with literally notebook-sized computers. They were a little thick, but they were notebook-sized. And Apple was way behind and was trying to catch up and trying to figure out how to transition from building things that sit on your desk to things that you carry around and everything that goes into that. And it was just a mess. And we were trying to, and then Apple had this other overhead that other companies didn't, which was, you know, a graphical interface that required an integrated pointing device, right? At that time, you know, you could, all the other products had these sort of clip-on trackballs, and they didn't really need to put it or use the mouse or whatever. They didn't really need to put it in the machine. And we felt we had to. And so all of a sudden, we have all this pressure around form factor, but we got to jam in at that time, which was a trackball. And one of my favorite memories was we were trying to figure this out, and there was this engineer there named John Krakauer, who was kind of a loose cannon. And he said, I got this idea. You can come over to my cubicle and see it. And he was doing this sort of puzzle game of moving all the pieces around and trying to figure out how to make space. And he said, look, here, if we push the keyboard back, there's a space in the front between the battery and the hard drive where we could put this trackball. And he was thinking more just how do you do it. And we looked at it and just said, oh my God, this is amazing. Because what it did was create this, you know, work surface that no matter where you went, on your lap, on your airline table, you had this sort of consistent workspace that was really turned out to be almost ergonomically perfect. And so we just ran with it. You know, we just said, look, we didn't do a lot of testing. You know, we did, of course, some usability work, which is like, okay, we're just going to make this, right? Because we're way behind and we don't have any choice. And today, you know, it is still the de facto standard for notebook computer. I mean, the trackball is replaced with a trackpad. Things have gotten much thinner, much more powerful, but it's still the same exact design, you know, after over 20 years, right? And so that, you know, that memory of seeing that and going, this is crazy, let's do it, you know, and just going and running it out to the market was an incredible experience. And messy and painful and, you know, just really hard, but we just did it.
I think that's a good indication that something might be worth trying if it makes you say, this is crazy, let's do it. Words to live by, words to design and roll out by there.
I wrote a book, it was all over a decade ago, but, you know, one of the headings of the chapters was, you know, risk is not a four-letter word, you know, and it really is. You know, in technology, if you're not taking any risks, you're probably going to die. So it's really something you have to be comfortable with.
Could you tell at that time with Apple that this company would keep, you know, for decades and decades on end after, keep growing and become just a leading force in the space of products and design?
Yes and no. It was, you know, the culture, you know, and that's, you know, I think that's really around, you know, Steve Jobs had two stints at Apple. And I often joke, I was between jobs. You know, he really set forth a culture of design appreciation. And Steve used to talk about the arts and how important the arts were to business, right? And that connection to culture through the arts. And I remember getting there and, you know, just seeing thoughtfulness in design everywhere. I mean, all the way to, you know, when you walk into the cafeteria and they've got this bulletin board of announcements and every piece on there was well designed and thoughtfully created, right? And just... And so that, I think what I saw is, wow, this is really incredible at this scale that you have everywhere you look, there is sensitivity around design. And then, you know, this sort of focus on just creating technology, really, you know, it sounds like a little bit of a cliche, but really for the betterment of people, right? It was sort of, you know, let's give people access as a primary idea, right? We're going to create amazing things that do amazing things, but at the top is make sure people can have access to it. Now, the challenges at the time is that at that time in history, you know, Apple was not fighting any small group of competitors. It was fighting an industry, right? It was the Windows Intel alliance that was, you know, dominating. the world of personal computing. So it wasn't just like taking on one industry. And that was actually why the company got in trouble for a while, is we were trying to do so much. You know, there was, at one point, we were in so many markets and had so many products, and it was just spread so thin, trying to make sure, you know, we sort of plug the holes in the dam to, you know, keep things moving. And that's when Steve came back for a second stint, you know, he really sort of cut like three quarters of the product line out and really focused what the company should be doing, which was the right thing to do. So when I left, you know, I did have concern for Apple and the leadership, because it was really sort of losing sight of its core values. There was a lot of, the growth was happening by bringing people in from other companies like Hewlett Packard and Sun Microsystems, and that weren't necessarily had this sort of understanding of design and culture. And I was spending more and more time just fighting to do the things we used to do automatically, right? And so at that time I was concerned, but then of course shortly after I left, Jobs came back and changed the company, and Johnny, who had hired and worked for me and recommended he take over the leadership design department, actually bonded with Steve, and you know, everyone knows the story. So.
Right, and that's a very famous Johnny for anybody who's an Apple fan there. But here's Johnny, and here's your pitch to sign up for the Podcasting to the Max newsletter, because you get terrible jokes and sometimes even movie references or Johnny Carson references if you look into the background of that, like that. If you sign up at maxpodcasting.com/newsletter, every Thursday you will get the Podcasting to the Max newsletter. It's where podcasting meets entrepreneurship and terrible puns that sometimes I think of on the spot, or sometimes I watch an infamous Stephen King movie in order to think of them. Anyway, sign up at maxpodcasting.com/newsletter, and it won't make you a very dull boy. Now, let's move to the beats and a quick stop at Pentagram. Your next stop after that was Pentagram. So somehow you went from a company that's known for design to a company that's even more known for design. So Pentagram's really, really cool company. And shout out Paula Scher, who we actually had on the podcast previously, principal at Pentagram. And she's amazing. I actually recorded that one from my, at the time, girlfriend's closet, because there were a lot of noise outside. So that was a fun one. Fun pictures of me in the closet. That girlfriend is now my wife, Dana. But... Pentagram, what are some of your highlights looking back on that time from working with such a thriving design focused, I don't know if you call it consultancy or company there?
Well, and actually Paula is amazing. She's continues to be one of my best friends. An incredible, incredible person, designer, force. Again, I often look back at, you know, I've become much more, you know, looking at my career and life and feeling some hand of the universe guiding me, because I was tired of Apple and longed for my days of Lunar, and thought, okay, maybe I'll start another design business. But, you know, honestly, it was kind of daunting. You know, I got to rent a space, I got to go buy a copier, I got to, you know, do all these things, I got to find employees, you know, just do everything from scratch again. And I was, I got invited to a luncheon at San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, and sat next to Kit Heinrichs, who's was a partner of Pentagram at that time, amazingly talented graphic designer. You know, we had a great conversation, and at one point towards the end of the luncheon, he leans over and says, "Hey, we're looking to bring on an industrial design partner. Do you know anybody? Nod, nod, wink, wink. You know, can you suggest anybody?" Right. And what, you know, what's interesting about that is, you know, Pentagram at that time and still was largely driven by the graphic side and visual design side of the business. It's really the foundation of the company. But I didn't see it that way. You know, it was called Pentagram because there were originally five partners. And one of them was Kenneth Grange, who was one of those designers I studied, you know, when I was in school. And Kenneth is an amazing industrial designer, British industrial designer. And so I had this image of Pentagram, not so much as being focused on that, but really as around Kenneth and his work. And then as I began to know Colin Forbes, who was one of the other founders, you know, the business model that he created was really fascinating in that it's sort of this, it's almost structured more like a law firm than a design firm, right? You have partners. Each partner has an area of focus. each partner has their own team and in many ways has their own line of business, but you operate under this umbrella and you use the brand and use the structure and use the resources of the company to build your own thing. And I thought, this is really amazing. I can pretty much go do my own thing, but jump into something, you know, with at that point, you know, some 30 years of relevance in the world. And in many ways, being asked to be a partner was like, you know, being the, you know, asked to be the queen of the prom. I mean, it was like, it was like very, very much an honor. And it was great. I mean, it really, you know, I was working with some of literally the best at what they do in the world, tackling really interesting design problems for some of the biggest, most powerful corporations in the world, but all with this thread of art and creativity and everything, right? It was just really very clear around what the company brought was this broader view of not just solving problems, but thinking of the how things fit in the world today and the culture that it's surrounded by, which to me, back to what I was interested in, really, really resonated.
Well, first of all, you'd have my vote for prom queen any day, Robert. So congrats on that. But we alluded to this with Apple, but your next stop after Pentagram was Beats by Dre. So super cool, I think, and especially at the start when you first heard about it and first saw the commercials and everything, we're like, wow, this is a really game-changing company in a really cool space. That was long before I got into audio. But really, really cool company there, and you've been partnering with them, you know, for about a decade and a half now-ish, a little bit, and counting. So that's awesome. But how did this opportunity present itself, and what is it that sold you on the idea to partner with these, you know, not that big name guys, Dr. Dre, Jimmy Iovine?
Well, it was, you know, again, those things, it's just serendipitous. And, you know, and I was still at Pentagram, but thinking about starting something new, which became Ammunition. And actually, I was contacted originally by a third party who had, he was interested in developing products in collaboration with the entertainment industry. And had somehow heard that Jimmy Iovine and Dr. Dre were interested in developing audio products, and somehow managed to get a meeting set up and said, you know, I want you to come along, you know. And so I'm like, yeah, I'll go, you know, I get to meet Dr. Dre. Sure, I'll go.
That part's not a hard sell.
Yeah, but it was wild. And so we went down, listened to what they're doing and what they wanted to do. And it was really an interesting thought that I remember in the first meeting, we were talking to Dre about why are you doing this? And he's made this statement, which we've actually for like 5 years put on the packaging, which was, he said, people aren't hearing my music. And we're like, well, what does that mean? He said, well, I spend an enormous amount of time crafting a sound, and then, you know, these kids are listening to it through quote unquote crappy white earbuds, you know, which is funny that crappy white earbud company bought them eventually, but
right. I wasn't going to say anything.
Basically, Jimmy had thought, look at two things here. One, we create much of the popular music. We know how it's supposed to sound. And so we want to build products that are designed and tuned to replicate that sound. The second thing, which, you know, Jimmy is an incredibly creative person, genius. And he saw that for his audience, you know, and that he was developing music and building artists, there was no high-performance audio brand. It just didn't exist, right? There was no, you know, it's like I would say Bose is your dad's headphone, right? So it just, there was nothing there. And he said, there's no, you know, for the people I'm talking to, nothing exists. And but then they had no idea what to do. They had no idea what they were doing. It was like, I mean, there's power in that, but it's also from where I sat was times just really frustrating. It's like, you guys have no idea what to do here to get something out in the world. And so, but, you know, so we went away and got this assignment to, okay, let's come up with some ideas for this headphone. And you got like 2 weeks. And so me and my team just poured everything into it. And the other thing that emerged from it, which was interesting, was that they wanted to do a business partnership, right? It wasn't just, we're going to hire you and pay you a fee, you know. And at the time, I was like, I didn't really, oh, wait, whatever. I get to work with Dr. Dre, so whatever, you know. And but, you know, and later I began to realize that's how they did everything. You know, when you go out and create an album or a song, it's a partnership really between the artist, the producer, the label, you know, everybody, you know, kind of takes a cut, right? And that's the way they view doing things. So anyway, we came back with all these ideas, you know, as much as we could do, and I've laid them all on the table. And I'll never forget this moment, because normally what would happen is people tend to be overwhelmed with multiple ideas, and you try and just kind of narrow it down, right? You just say, okay, let's get it down to a smaller group so we can kind of focus and figure it out. And they're looking and explaining to them, and they walked up to this one sketch and said, that. Let's do that. And I was like, that one? And they're like, yes. Don't fuck around. Do that. And I was like, okay, this is great. And I agreed, you know, that was a really strong direction, you know, which was the original studio. And it actually, the original sketch was pretty close. And so we went off through this really roller coaster ride of creating the product, and it was amazing. And strangely, to me, you know, being Silicon Valley design nerd, somehow I connected with them well, especially Jimmy, who at times has been a great friend, a supporter, and then a total thorn and, you know, pain in the ass. But, you know, it actually worked. And I later realized that they viewed me as an artist too. They viewed me in the same, you know, not to put myself in the same boat, but in the same way they looked at Lady Gaga, right? It was just like they saw, you know, an artist who could be, who they could push and get to do great work and so forth and so on. So I began to realize that's why we had that connection.
I think there's something really energizing about when you're looking at potential options and whoever the client is or whoever you're partnering with, it just goes all in on one right away. And it's like, yeah, yes, let's do it. Like, it can be a little bit jarring, but it's also when there's that conviction there, it's like you, when that passion comes from the initial selection and like, all right, this is the path we're going to go on, I feel like it saves so much time and so much back and forth and can really energize a team. That is awesome to hear that that's what happened with Beats.
Well, yeah. And I've actually been trying to figure out how to write my second book.
Oh, the man who rejected Apple, you mean?
That one. Well, that's my third, but it's, you know, it's really around this sort of idea of how you go from good to great, right? You know, there's a lot of things you can do to follow the process and have good talent, you know, to turn out good work. But, you know, then there's these things that move the needle, these things that sort of change the world and change markets and change culture. And how does that happen? And, you know, as I've gone through my career and looked at all those situations like Beats, it usually comes down to the maniacal focus of one or a small number of individuals that will not accept anything but amazing and just are hell-bent to do that. You know, as a designer, you need those partners, right? If you're going to do something that really changes the world, you need those partners. That's what it was. It was like Jimmy in particular, Andre was like, this has to be fucking great, Robert. And I'm going to call you up every Saturday morning and yell at you until it is. You know, it's like, so, you know, and then you find you hang on to those people, right? Because they will help you do amazing stuff.
I think there's something to that absolute there, and almost focus on obsession, but also focus on the negative that you hear about with like Michael Jordan and Kobe, of like they hated losing more than they enjoyed winning, and like wouldn't accept, you know, anything less than being the best. And so that obviously applies in the sports world, but it applies in the art and design and in business world as well. And I'm fired up. Like, I want to go buy Beats by Dre right now, because you got me fired up.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, if Jimmy Iovine is a really interesting man, and if you can go out and find interviews with him, there's one thing that he says, which is really interesting, that, you know, he will say his primary motivator was fear, you know, of not being the best and not being, you know, he really in his early in his career had to really fight to get into the studio and become, you know, the top-notch producer he was, and working with Bruce Springsteen and John Lennon and everybody he did early on. But, you know, he was this outsider that did that. And so he today will say, you know, I just constantly, what drives me is the fear of irrelevancy, or the fear of being mediocre, or the fear, you know, it's an interesting paradox.
I'm afraid we're going to transition, see what I did there, to ammunition. And this is a really, really interesting part of your career, an ongoing part of your career, because as you alluded to with Lunar from your earlier days, like this isn't the first time that you went out on your own or started going out on your own. But this is, I think you've built an amazing team, and we don't have time to talk through all the projects today, but if you go to ammunitiongroup.com and check out the amazing products that you've worked on, like it's just endless and endlessly cool, even looking at the pictures and learning about them. But what convinced you to fully go all in at this point into really more the realms of entrepreneurship with ammunition?
Yeah, there's some interesting things that were happening. So I was at Pentagram, and you know, while Pentagram, as I've said, was an amazing company, an amazing model, you know, I had this problem in that I was really like a boutique within the company and doing product design. There was really only one other designer and that was doing industrial design, and he, Danny Weil, his approach was and areas he worked in was very different than mine. You know, and then I started looking externally, and a lot of things that were going on that were sort of elevating the role of industrial design in the business community. And one of the dominant ones, of course, was the success of Apple, and almost any product they put an eye in front of, you know, just became, you know, world changing. And so people began to look and say, wait a minute, what is this industrial design thing, right? It's, we need to know how to do that. And I just didn't think I was in the right place and positioned correctly to do that. And so I thought, okay, and I'll never forget, I actually, my wife and I were on our honeymoon. We were in Nicaragua and we're sitting on the beach, and I was, you know, complaining, you know, about where I was and what I needed to do. And she says, you know, and she just looked at me, why don't you just shut up and go do that? You know? And so I came back and quit, which was actually shocking to the partnership. Very few people have ever quit Pentagram. You either were fired or you died. You know, that was sort of how you left the company. But to my partner's credit, they were as supportive as possible. And I had this unique situation where I was the only one that did what I was doing in the company, right? So my employees weren't transferable. My clients weren't transferable. So it was sort of like I could, and there was a culture at Pentagram, like what you've created is yours. And so I, you know, left and took my team of that time, about 11 people or so. And one day we were Pentagram and the next day we were Ammunition. But the idea was, it was a little Pentagram-like, but it with a little bit of a focus, in that I had learned through my time at Apple that, you know, creating amazing things was a multidisciplinary process, right? It wasn't just the industrial designer. It really was thinking through everything about the product and what it was and how it behaved and how people learned about it and how it was constructed, and everything went into it, right? So the notion was to create this multidisciplinary firm, but with products at the center, product as a focus. And then the other thing which happened, which was extremely important, was, you know, there was two things. I did, you know, of course, I told you the Beat story and partnership. I'd also helped start a really small company creating barbecues called Fuego. You know, it was, you know, we were really small. I mean, we did like $10 or $15 million of sales a year or something. But we kind of changed the world of outdoor equipment design, because we took this very sort of architectural modernist approach to it. But the thing that was phenomenal to me was, you know, I was an owner of the company, part owner. I had, I was on the board of directors in the little company, you know, but I realized that, you know, I wasn't having to sell things. People were listening and just saying, okay, you know, do that, right? And I began to see this sort of power of being in a different business model, not just potentially economically, but being able to really more drive and control your destiny. I started Ammunition and later brought on a couple of the partners. A part of our emphasis was to build these relationships, and that started to take form in two ways. One, the Beats relationship just grew and became huge, and the second was we were working with a lot of startups, and it was at a point where hardware startups were really growing in Silicon Valley, and we would take ownership in those companies. We would invest in those companies. And it had, you know, again, sort of the potential, you're hoping, you know, maybe you hit a couple out of the park, but also, again, it sort of changed the way we worked. It actually, when we were part of the proposition, A, as I said before, people really paid attention to what we wanted to do, but also we were so tied into the business, it made us better designers, you know, really sort of taking everything into consideration, not just what kind of portfolio piece we're going to get out of it. And so that became a foundation of the company, this really sort of entrepreneurial approach where we're, you know, becoming part of the business of the people we work with and building partnerships.
In partnerships and projects, there's so many cool projects, as I alluded to before, that you and the team at Ammunition have worked on and brought into this world. I'm not going to make you, you know, pick your favorite child, but is there one product or project in addition to, you know, besides Beats and Fuego, that with Ammunition is just, it's just very memorable for you working on it for whatever reason?
You know, one of the ones was the work that we did for Square and working with Jack Dorsey. And because we got involved in Square, they had done their first credit card reader, which was just such a phenomenal idea and game changing thing across so many. I mean, you know, it used to be that, you know, to take a Visa card was an arduous process to get set up and, you know, everything you do. And then all of a sudden you could get online, click a few boxes. Next thing you knew, you were taking credit cards to sell your sneakers on the sidewalk, right? And it just changed everything. But they had a lot of problems with the product and it hadn't really been figured out. And so we redesigned the reader, and then we were given this assignment, which was really to rethink the cash register, you know, which became this Square stand. It changed the face of retail, really, especially in small business, right? And that process of developing that, and to Jack's credit, he wanted to do an amazing piece of design and was willing to, again, go that extra mile to make sure it was amazing. And so it was, again, another one of those opportunities when, you know, we could really drive something and make something incredible and have the support of the leadership to do it and take all those extra steps and go through all that pain to do it, make it just right. And then again, it changed the world of retail. And so that those kind of things are the things you look back and say, you know, wow, that was a great thing, but really it was such a phenomenal thing that went out in the world and changed so many people's lives.
As if we had a Square to spare, let's wrap up with some rapid fire Q&A. You ready for it?
All right, let's do it.
All right, let's get wild. What does Dr. Dre go by in the office? Dr. Dre, Andre, what do people call him?
Dre. It's Dre. That's it.
Easy enough. Yeah, perfect.
No Andre. No, it's just Dre.
Removing his medical credentials there. How about, I heard this a lot. I think I heard it back when I was in college, but there's this longtime rumor or myth that Beats by Dre would test new headphones by playing Into Club by 50 Cent or 50 Cent. Do you know of any truth to that?
I hate it. I was so sick of that song. I mean, that was like always, you know, any for a while, any evaluation of the audio performance or something was Into Club. And I just got, it's like that opening riff. It was just like, oh God, do I have to hear this again? Yeah, absolutely true. Well, you know, and when you listen to it, you know, there were a lot of things going on in the song that, and different channels of sound that really could, you know, help you evaluate the products we were doing and listen to how they were playing. And, you know, of course, I don't have anywhere near the ear of Jimmy or Dre, but it was a good test case. But I just heard it so many times, I was like, I never want to hear the song again. I mean, to this day, if it comes on the radio, I get kind of like, oh God, not again. Great song, though.
Poor Curtis Jackson. Well, no, thanks for confirming it. That's really, really cool. And shout out my buddy and college roommate, Alex, who I think first told me about that. And I was like, that sounds like a cool story, but I don't know if they actually do it. But here we go. You heard it here first, or you heard it here 1,000th. How about, besides Dre and Jimmy, see, you got me. I'm just calling him Dre now. Who's somebody else in the music industry that you met through that time there that was just kind of a pinch me moment for you?
In the beginning, before Beats had its own, and even after, they were right down there with Universal Music, right? And for a while, it was Jimmy's office, and then we got moved into a building next door. You know, every meeting you showed up, you never knew, right, who was going to be in there, right? And, you know, everyone from, you know, Pharrell Williams, Will.i.am, Oliver Stone. I mean, it was always just like somebody there, you know? And it actually was problematic because you know, while they would be amazing talents, amazing musicians, they weren't necessarily, didn't know that much about design. And so they would make a statement, and then I would spend like 3 months unraveling it because it was totally detrimental to what we were doing. But out of all those, I mean, the one that actually that we continued to work with on and off for a long time was Pharrell Williams. He was not just, you know, obviously Pharrell, just a, such a sensitive, design-aware individual that, you know, sometimes we were actually collaborating, sometimes it was just Pharrell's opinion, but it was always super valuable and just an amazing person to work with. The funny story was the one person I wanted to meet that I never did was Bono, right? And Bono and Jimmy were best friends, but just never worked. And then later, Johnny Ive mentioned had his had this wild 50th birthday party in the UK, and at the party was Bono, and you two played. And it was like 4 a.m. I was pretty much wasted. I finally walked up to Bono and introduced myself. And I realized later I was probably slurring my speech. And he was like, "Who is this drunken fool?" And that was the time that I actually finally got to meet Bono, which was, it was great. So I always look back at that time and it's such a wild ride and so amazing and really, you know, I met so many people that I never in my lifetime thought I would meet with, let alone work with, and it was incredible.
Music to my ears. Couldn't resist. Robert, thank you so much. This has been an absolute blast, and just absolutely love speaking with you and learning from you and your amazing journey and stories. And where is the best place, in addition to ammunitiongroup.com, for people to learn more or connect with you online?
I mean, probably my Instagram and the company Instagram, and the company is at Ammunition Group, and mine is at Robert D, as in Dennis Spruner. Those, you know, we tend to put a lot of stuff up about what's happening, and it's a channel to communicate through. But if anyone is interested in our company, or you know, you can go through our website, and there's email to be able to send us questions or whatever, and happy to contact people. So. Also, you could find me on LinkedIn as well, although I get so many sales requests on LinkedIn anymore. It's not the best spot.
Right. I'll send you a sales request, right? Some spammy stuff right after this. Now, Robert, thanks again. Last thing, final thoughts, just a quote or words to live by. Send us home here.
I've done a lot of challenging things, and at times it gets really hard. And I think the one thing I've always learned is just keep moving forward, right? Sometimes it's just that single step you take. Don't get overwhelmed. Don't get stagnant. Just keep moving forward, and you'll get through it, and you'll move to the next step. So never stand still. Always move forward.
Keep it moving. Thank you so much, Robert, for your incredible, all you've done for design and entrepreneurship, and sharing the behind the scenes inside scoop across your career. And thank you, Wild listeners, for tuning in to another episode. If you want to hear more wild stories like this one, make sure to follow the Wild Business Growth Podcast on your favorite podcast app and tell a friend about the podcast. And then start making sketches with them, and you never know what it can turn into. You can also find us on Good Pods, where there are really, really good podcasts and podcast people and podcast recommendations. And for any help with podcast production, you can learn more at maxpodcasting.com and sign up for the Podcasting to the Max newsletter. That's at maxpodcasting.com/newsletter. Until next time, let your business run wild.
Bring on the bongos!